We're going to be in Daniel chapter 1 this morning. And we're really just at the beginning of this study. And if you were here last week, you remember we spent the whole class doing an introduction of the book of Daniel. And we talked about a wide range of things. We talked about the authorship of the book. We talked about how there have been critics and skeptics over the years that have challenged the authorship of Daniel in multiple ways, not just who wrote it, but Daniel is a different book because it's split. There's a split in it. Who remembers what that split consists of? How does it split? And also the tone in the book, and said, maybe Daniel wrote part of this, but there's no way that Daniel wrote all of it. And one of the main critiques of the book was actually the accuracy of the prophecies. We talked about that last week, and how some would say there's no way that prophecy this accurate and this precise could have actually been issued before the events took place. And so one claim that we talked about is that part of Daniel was written after the lifetime of Daniel by another person writing under the name of Daniel. We talked about how that kind of clashes with not only our beliefs, but also with fairly recent archaeological discoveries. We talked about how Daniel is included in the Dead Sea Scrolls discovery, and how those claims would require that parts of the documents in that discovery were written a few decades before they were found, which clashes with the dating that most people would apply to the text and the manuscripts. So none of that really fits together. So what we conclude is that Daniel was written by Daniel and that it is a book of prophecy. We talked about how there is symmetry in the text. We talked about the chiastic structure of chapters 2 through 7. I think that was kind of a new concept. It was for me the first time I studied it. And we presented some goals for the study, and one of those goals is for us to see Daniel's character and see how God cares for his own people, and to challenge ourselves as Bible students. And I think we're all going to be challenged by this study. I know I've been challenged by it already, and I hope that it's fruitful and challenging for everyone. I want to pick up and overlap a little bit with some of the discussion we did last week on the timeline and the setting of this first chapter of Daniel that we're going to read this morning. I just wanted to maybe do a mixture of review and also see how much we already know. Which Babylonian king took Daniel and his friends captive? Nebuchadnezzar, right. Who knows who preceded Nebuchadnezzar as king in Babylon? I'll give you a clue. His dad has a really common name, just like Nebuchadnezzar does. So that'd be Nabopolassar. Yeah. I know, you run into those people all the time. I was talking to my dad yesterday about names, because maybe some of y'all have heard about Alexa. Some of you know who Alexa is. Alexa is a Pat's got one? You've got an Alexa? Okay, so if you don't know who Alexa is, if you shop on Amazon, you can buy a device that'll sit in your house, and whenever you want it to do something for you, like order a pizza, or if you have your house wired up certain ways, you can tell it to turn on the stove, preheat the oven, you just say, Alexa, call the fire department, right? And my dad was saying, why Alexa? And I said, because, you know, Dad, if they don't want it to be, hey, John, because the guy that just came over to have dinner with you is going to, you know, the device isn't going to know who you're talking to. So Alexa, Siri, all the companies are picking really obscure names. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, Nabopolassar, those might have been good options too. But some historians believe, and I think that this is probably a pretty fair assumption, that when Daniel and his three friends were taken captive, Nebuchadnezzar might have been on his way back to reclaim the throne after his father died. And he was campaigning in Egypt at the time. And so it might have just been a stopover. But there was also a lot of other significant military stuff going on at the time. And so I want to just put a few dates in front of you here. I think I mentioned this last week. The first time I did a really serious study of Daniel, we were talking about dates constantly. Some people liked that, some people didn't. I'm not gonna get us too into the weeds on dates, but I think they help a little bit. So 605 BC, I think, is roughly where the book of Daniel starts. That's where it opens. This is the third year of King Jehoiakim. It's also the first of three sieges on the city of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. And this is when I think the story opens. Daniel and his three friends are taken captive. They're taken back to Babylon. This is generally thought to be the beginning of the Jewish captivity. If these dates clash with something you've learned in the past, you know, please don't let what I'm saying or what you've been taught, you know, bother you or cause any kind of a contradiction in your mind. These dates are kind of contested sometimes. But the general consensus seems to be that 605 BC is roughly the right time period. A couple of other things I thought I would throw out there. A little bit later, the second siege of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar is going to happen in 597. The reason for this is Jehoiakim had revolted, and he had decided he's not going to pay tribute to Babylon anymore. So Nebuchadnezzar says, okay. He mobilizes his army. They go back to Jerusalem. They siege Jerusalem a second time. And this is when he will take one of his own people, Zedekiah, and install him as a ruler in Judah. And he's kind of saying, okay, you know, if I have to worry about the people of Judah revolting against me, I'm going to put my own person in place, and then I know I won't have a problem. And that really didn't work out either, because about 8 years later, the guy that he installed decided he had had enough of Babylon, and he switched his allegiance to Egypt. And so Nebuchadnezzar came back for a third time, for a third siege, to put down Zedekiah. I tend to think that this is the story that is mentioned in 2 Kings 25. I tend to think that that's the same date that corresponds there. There are some sources that might put 2 Kings 25 and the siege that's talked about in that chapter at the second siege. I'm not real sure, honestly. I don't have a real strong opinion on that. But it kind of seems to me that it fits that third siege. So some of the recent events that we talked about are on this slide that lead up to chapter 1. And we also talked about the contemporaries of Daniel, the prophets that had been on the earth during Daniel's lifetime and prior. Who remembers one or two prophets that lived at the same time as Daniel? Ezekiel, yep. Jeremiah. Yeah, those are the two that probably come to mind first. I decided to change the timeline slide on you this morning. This one's a little less bad than the one I had last week. By bad, I just mean hard to read. I mean, it seems to be all accurate information. But Daniel's up there in the top lane along with prophets. Obadiah seems to overlap with his lifetime, and, you know, preceded by Isaiah. Just to give you some historical context, because sometimes, at least I know I do this, as I read the Bible, I forget that it's not chronological always. It's more organized than it is chronological. And so it helps, at least I think it helps in a study like this, to have a frame of reference as far as when things are happening. So let's move on to chapter 1. I'm going to read the first 7 verses or so if you want to follow along with me. And I'm reading in the New American Standard. I'm going to read the first 7 verses of Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them, and to Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. So we'll pause right there for a second. Some critics would point to the very first verse of this book and draw a contradiction to what is stated in Jeremiah chapter 25. Daniel says that this takes place in the third year of King Jehoiakim. If you read Jeremiah 25 verse 1, it says the fourth year. Just curious if anybody has thoughts on why that supposed contradiction or inconsistency might be there. Yeah. Math is hard.
Well, just as a point of reference, in some parts of Asia, they count your first year as while you were in the womb. And so when you are born, you're 1 year old. So we think counting is easy because we've always done it a certain way. But lots of cultures count differently, how they count beginnings and endings. So, for example, if Daniel is counting as the Babylonians did, they may count by calendar year. So 1 to 12 months is a year, whereas Jeremiah could say the first year was November to December, and the second year starts in January to the following. So
sure.
It's just some differences in counting. Also, it takes a long time to walk and ride animals from Jerusalem all the way to Babylon. So it could be both, just because when they left could be the third year, when they arrived before.
Sure. If you didn't hear all of Adam's comments, the first point he made was that people count things differently in different places. So if you go over to parts of Asia, they might count the whole time that a baby is in the womb as their first year of life, versus here we don't start the clock until they come into the world. And also just how long it took for information to travel from point A to point B in this time period versus now. And yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, it's hard for us sometimes to think about those things. At least it is for me. I'm one who wants to pounce on these kinds of inconsistencies when I spot them. I want to squish them so that I don't have to worry about that anymore. So there's nothing to worry about here. But I think, you know, as Adam pointed out, Jeremiah is speaking from the Hebrew standpoint, whereas Daniel might have been writing more from a Babylonian perspective at the time that he penned this. And in Babylon, they didn't count the first year, the year that a king was appointed. When a king was anointed, as far as we understand historically, that first year wasn't really counted. It wasn't until he had a full calendar year. So the third year of Jehoiakim, to a Hebrew writer, would be the fourth year of Jehoiakim. Or the other way around. The fourth year would be, to a Hebrew writer, would be the same as the third year to the Babylonian writer. Seems to be a pretty reasonable explanation to me. So Jerusalem is besieged by Nebuchadnezzar. That's what we read in this first passage. What's a siege?
When you seal it up, nobody goes out.
Okay, so a city that's under siege is sealed up, nobody goes in, nobody goes out. How come?
They starve them out.
Yeah. If you wanna find out how horrible life can really be, go spend some time on Wikipedia with the word siege. It's pretty terrible. I mean, I find some of this stuff fascinating in kind of a weird way, because it's not the way wars are fought anymore. You know, we can fly a cruise missile down somebody's air conditioning vent if we want to these days. There's no need for these sieges, at least not the way they used to happen a long time ago. But sieges could last for years. A siege was not just a few months. A few months would be pretty bad. But sieges could last for years and years and years. I got curious, so I decided to research this. The longest known siege that I could find any record of was the siege of a city called Candia on the island of Crete that lasted for 21 years. And it involved a naval bombardment. This was in the 1600s. And there have been a lot of paintings about that siege, just these massive frescoes full of 17th century warships just bombarding that city for 21 years. That siege went on. To the point that those who were born early on in that siege could have fought during its final battles. Can you imagine living your entire childhood in a siege? I just want to try to set the stage for what this really consisted of here. It's horrible. There have been multiple sieges in the history of Jerusalem, and I gave you the dates for three of the most noted ones, right, on the previous slide. So that's a little bit about the background and the setting of Daniel chapter 1 as we get into this chapter. And so what's the point, you might ask, of reviewing so much history? I think it's just to imagine as much as possible what Daniel was seeing and thinking and feeling as he was taken captive to Babylon. Because to me, that adds to my amazement at the way he conducts himself and the way he responds to the challenges that are going to happen in the following chapters. You know, he was taken from his land. I don't think any of us know what that feels like, do we? Has anybody been ever taken from your land? I don't ask that facetiously. I mean, I don't. Well,
Trusta was
yeah.
Alex took Trusta.
You rescued Trusta?
Hey, she was made it both ways.
That's a good way to look at it. And imagine that a foreign power invades your land, and you watch this foreign power pillage and plunder your land. And if that's not enough, suddenly you find yourself to be physically a part of the plunder. You and your three friends are part of the loot that's being taken away. You're being taken, like so many possessions, to another land where they don't speak your language, where they don't worship your God, and where they don't necessarily have any regard for your determination to worship your God. That's the situation that Daniel's in. Yeah, John.
Do we know what age they were taken away at?
I don't know for sure, but I believe he's a teenager. Anybody want to comment on that?
What was your question?
John asked, do we know what age Daniel and his friends were when they were taken? The only reason I say teenager is because we do kind of have a rough idea of how long Daniel lived and how many years pass, because he serves under multiple kings. He's gonna serve under Darius as well. Not even just multiple kings, but multiple empires, so to speak.
The idea is that the younger they are, the easier it would be not really care.
To just go along, get along with... You don't think they'd know the difference? Yeah. Yeah, I think they might know the difference, but... Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying.
I think in terms of Daniel's age, he and his friends are old enough to have resolve from the Lord, so yeah. You have to assume they've reached some level of what we would consider at least teenage years, I think. It's unlikely you can see a 9 or 10 year old, I think, show this sort of resolve
sure.
to serve the Lord. So
yeah,
I think
a great
the
point.
Assumption that they are mid teens makes sense, especially since Daniel's gonna live for over 70 years of service. So I don't think we generally assume he lives to be 100.
Right.
And so there is certainly some time bounding there. Most people I know would say he's called between 15 and 20.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking too. Yeah, 15, 20, somewhere in there. Yeah, I kind of wish we get in the third year of this king and the fourth year of that king. I want to know in what year of the hero of this story are we talking, right? But sometimes we just have to pin it down as best we can. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar, that's a great point. It says here in these first seven verses that his goal for selecting these men was that they be well-educated, they be, you know, wise, and have been instructed in the ways of their land so that they could be repurposed, right, for the purposes that he had in the land of the Chaldeans. Going to be hard to do that with somebody who hasn't at least sort of come of age. That's great discussion. I want to draw your attention to one last thing before we move on to a few more verses. If you'll look back at verse 2. Verse 2 says, "The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God." The Lord gave Jehoiakim into his hand. This is a theme that I think is going to be popping up over and over again for us in this study, and I want to draw your attention to it now so that you can watch for it. But in one of the resources I have in preparing this class, the author puts it like this: God rules in the kingdoms of men. And in verse 2, that's the first statement of that theme in the book of Daniel, is that these kings war with each other. They make their plans. They snatch power from each other. They steal people from this country to put them in this country. They do all of these things. But at the top level, God is deciding the outcome of these things. God is moving the pieces on the chessboard. He rules in the kingdom of men. So watch for that to pop up over and over again throughout this study. I think it's a theme of Daniel. Yeah, that's a great segue into the next thing I wanted to say. Donna was just pointing out the possible tie back to previous kings like Josiah. I think there's another example that we can take from the book of Jeremiah. If you want to look at Jeremiah chapter 37 with me real quick, I think we have time to read a little bit of this. We don't need to read the whole section. I mentioned a second ago that there were three sieges, and during the second siege is when Nebuchadnezzar had had enough, and he did what? He appointed somebody, right? He appointed one of his own men. He put Zedekiah in place. If you look at Jeremiah 37, verse 1, it says, "Now Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had made king in the land of Judah, reigned as king in place of Kaniah, the son of Jehoiakim." Donna, is this the exact story you were referring to? Yeah, so if you read back through chapter 36 of Jeremiah, what you read about is that Jehoiakim burnt the scroll of Baruch. Who's Baruch? He's the scribe of Jeremiah, right? And as a result, the Lord says his rule will end. So Donna, you read my mind on that. Appreciate you pointing that out. There's prophecy being fulfilled all over the place. It's not just Daniel's prophecy in our study that's going to build our faith, but this ties back to what we studied recently in Jeremiah. It ties back to the Kings and the Chronicles. I think that's amazing, frankly. There are lots of connections like this that, you know, I forget about unless I study it all the time. Do you have a comment? You know, I didn't have that one in my notes, so Isaiah 39. Yeah, so verse 5, "Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, 'Hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and all that your fathers have laid up in store to this day will be carried to Babylon. Nothing will be left,' says the Lord." Thank you for pointing that out. "And some of your sons who will issue from you," possibly talking about Daniel and his three friends and all the other people that they took along with him. Yeah. Great point. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. Right. Donna's comment was, as you read through, sometimes as we read through the books of Kings and Chronicles, especially 2 Kings for me, I taught that in the high school class recently, it kind of wears you down sometimes because you think that there don't seem to be very many believers in these stories. But Donna's point is, obviously there had to be in order for men like Daniel and his three friends to be taken to Babylon and for what we're about to read to even take place. There had to be believers. There had to be faithful people amongst the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, despite so many chapters, so many kings, so many stories where it just seems like the unrighteousness of all the people are being punished. Yeah, Derek? Yeah. 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 I appreciate you pointing that out. If you didn't hear Derek's comment, he was just pointing out that it's kind of frightening as you read some of these Old Testament accounts where the righteous are punished right along with the unrighteous in some cases. They end up paying the price for the iniquity of the whole group or the whole kingdom. That's something that I struggle with, and that might resonate with us in America today as we see the direction that our country takes in some cases. It can be kind of a frightening thing to think we may not necessarily, get preserved or protected from the worldly trials that come along with God's punishment on a nation. That may be the case even today. Yeah.
Well, I think Hebrews 12 would tell us that what we should expect is that God's discipline for His people may include this, right? Like Derek has referenced this in terms of, we are good people, and those around us may be judged, and we'll get harmed along with them. But Hebrews 12 would tell us that actually, as Christians, we may need to get comfortable with the fact that God may be doing it to the nation because He's disciplining us, because He loves us, and they get to enjoy the discipline along with us. So I think sometimes we see these things as God is harming or doing harm to those who are not serving Him, and Christians or God's people are hurt because of that. But there are lots of passages in the Bible that indicate that God disciplines His people because He loves them, and those in the nations are affected because of God's love for His people.
Yeah, Dwayne?
What we want and think is good and best is not necessarily the way God sees it. Whoever you look at in the Bible that went through a hard time, God preserved them and took care of them, even though it might have appeared that life was really tough. Think of Elijah. He's starving to death, had nowhere to go. He lived in a cave, and the crows brought him food. Now, that ain't good. However, it could have been worse. So if God was taking care of him in His own way and understanding perfectly clear that things were going to be okay with Elijah.
Yeah.
Although Elijah didn't quite get it. And I don't think we're a whole lot different sometimes. I shudder to think of what it would be like if, quote, we lost our freedom. Well, friend, we've lost it.
Well, it's certainly it's certainly a tough concept for me. I'll tell you, at this point in my development as a Christian, I struggle a lot with understanding God's discipline or wrath or destruction or whatever you want to call it as you compare it from the Old to the New Testament. It's something that I think I'm going to spend my whole life really digging into and trying to understand, but I think that it is a sobering concept for all of us. I pray for safety for my kids, for me. You know, I hope that even though I fail constantly, my efforts to live a godly life will not just be rewarded in eternity, right? But I think we all would agree that it would be great if those efforts could kind of shelter us and protect us in this life too. Donna, we'll do one more and then I'm going to move on to the next section. Yeah.
And he took care of. But those first years when he was first taken had to be traumatic.
Oh, yeah.
For a young man to be thrown in a pit and then sold.
I agree. And I think the first years of Daniel's life would have been traumatic too, even though he's living in a king's palace. He's been taken from his land. He's been taken from his home. Yeah, those are all great points. I want to read the next 8 verses or so. You guys are allowed to tell me when I have my glasses on my head while I'm teaching. You can, you can speak up and let me know.
I just thought you were concerned it was going to be really bright.
No. Thought I had LASIK surgery recently.
Yeah.
So let's continue on. Verse 8. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the other youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were to drink and kept giving them vegetables. Why do you think the king's food would defile Daniel?
I'd be finished that they couldn't eat or pork.
Okay. Yeah, so one possibility is the food was taken from animals that are considered unclean under the law of Moses, right? Any other possibilities that come to mind? There you go, that's another one. So maybe some of the food that was on the king's table had already been offered to a false god on an altar and therefore was profane. Those are the two main reasons I came up with. You know, there's also some preparations under the Mosaic law for food to be considered clean or to maintain cleanliness. It could be that, you know, some of the food didn't meet those qualifications either. It could have been a combination of all three. What's the chief eunuch concerned about? Yeah, he's concerned about being put to death because what Daniel is proposing is not compatible with the king's instructions, right? They're not the same. So the chief eunuch ends up deciding to go along with this for a test period because Daniel believes that the end result that the king is after is going to be it's going to be reached anyway. And that's really what the king cares about.
Also, verse 9, God granted Daniel favor.
Right. Yeah, so God's hand is in this, for sure. Think about, for a minute, the nature of the help that Daniel has received from God here in these verses. Does it demonstrate a scientific advantage to a vegetarian diet?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I certainly don't.
And Adam hopes not. And I hope not too. I think it demonstrates God's ability and willingness to act miraculously for his purposes to be served. I think that... Yeah, first 6-7 chapters anyway. I'm going to finish out the chapter real quick. I think I have about six. Yeah, go ahead.
Just one thing real quick is, I think in verse 8 of chapter 1 and also in verse 14 of chapter 2, we see some of Daniel's character and maybe the way as believers that we should interact with those that don't believe when they're asking us to maybe do something incompatible with our beliefs. Daniel did not kind of buck up and say, I'm not going to eat this food and you can kill me if you want to. He may have gotten to that point eventually, but his first stop was to go and have a conversation and to deal openly and compassionately.
Yeah, he showed some diplomacy, right?
In chapter 2, verse 14, it actually says that he was compassionate to Arioch, who was coming to tell him, I have to kill you.
Sure.
And so just something for us to consider as we're interacting with those that maybe would do us harm or are asking us to do something opposed to our beliefs, our first stop does not have to be combative and potentially come off as arrogant or prideful. Instead, we can come across as compassionate and loving.
Yeah, great point. I want to come back to that in about 3 minutes. I've got some wrap-up, and I want to come back to that. So in verse 17, I'm going to finish this up real quick. As for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Then at the end of the days which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, so they entered the king's personal service. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. I just imagine what it would be like to receive all manner of wisdom and knowledge from God on any subject. The line of work I'm in, I have to learn all the time. I can never really rest from trying to learn and trying to keep up with the changing technologies that are coming along. And it's hard. You know, it's a lot of work, and it's hard to do it. And really all I'm getting is my best ability to learn something. I can't even imagine what it would be like to receive knowledge. I mean, we read of Solomon receiving wisdom. James tells us, if you ask for wisdom, you'll receive it. Knowledge, though, to me, those are two different things. And I'm jealous of what Daniel received here. So he and his three companions stand out. Consider this last statement. They were 10 times better. Does that mean literally 10 times better? Does that mean they were measured?
Maybe 100 more questions than the other person.
Yeah.
They didn't have the SATs.
Oh boy. No, I don't think it means literally 10 times better. This is the first of many times, by the way, in the book of Daniel, where a specific number is going to be used as a symbol for better or bigger or so far into the future that we can't comprehend it. Watch for that as well. Watch for the use of numbers in this book and when we detour into Revelation as symbols rather than literal measurements. So to wrap this up, a couple of the themes that I mentioned I want to hit on. For Daniel's character, he didn't compromise on his beliefs. And to Adam's point, what did that look like? You know, Daniel didn't go, no, that's not how that looked. He decided to stick around instead of lose his head and look at all Look at all the things that God was able to accomplish through Daniel's life. That's an attitude. That's not just character. That's an attitude. That's an outlook on other people and on oneself. That's a skill, I think, that all of us need, is the ability to be firm, but not combative and not difficult. And I'm the poorest example of both. There's no reason for me to be leading a lesson on those subjects, but that's where we should be. We should be meek, and we should have at least the desire, if not the ability, but the desire to try to stand up for what we believe in a way that isn't just going to slam the door shut so that others won't care or won't want to know more about it. He did. He reasoned with them, and he showed diplomacy. I think he kind of created an ally in that chief official. He won the credibility is not the word I'm looking for, but he influenced that official. Yeah, Derek. Yeah.
A lot of times I kind of gloss over that. I think, man, Daniel just, he knew what he was going to do, and that was it with the hard form, but he had to sit down and decide, I can do this and not make any waves. Or I can say, no, I'm not going to come.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is important.
And he obviously put his faith in God. Now, we say that a lot. Is there really an area of the Bible, of Scripture, where you can't pull putting faith in God out as some kind of an application? I mean, we say it so much, I wonder if we just... We gloss over it maybe, but if it loses its meaning, I want to park there for a minute. Here's what putting your faith in God means in this story. It means putting yourself at risk of some kind of punishment or of rejection in order to stay obedient.
Fearlessly.
What's that?
Fearlessly.
Fearlessly. Well, yeah, maybe on the outside. But that's real for us. I don't care what job you have or what station you are in life or what point in life you're at. Having the fear of rejection or punishment or some kind of consequence is there for all of us, right? Putting your faith in God means remaining obedient in spite of it. And we see that, you know, God is caring for his own people in this story. And I think the last thing I want to mention is that If you think of yourself as a child of God and you look at what Daniel's gone through here, just remember, children of God don't go untested. Part of God's fatherhood for us involves testing us. And I think Daniel's character gives us something to shoot for. And I hope you can take that with you this week. I really appreciate all the comments and the discussion this morning. We'll get into Daniel chapter 2 next Sunday.